Welcome to a special edition of the Washington AI Network podcast, recorded at the Seed AI House at South by Southwest. I'm Tammy Haddad, and today you'll hear from two influential voices on Capitol Hill. Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota, he's co-chair of the Senate AI Caucus, and Congressman Zach Nunn of Iowa. They share how artificial intelligence is reshaping everything from healthcare breakthroughs to national security priorities. Let's begin with Senator Mike Rounds. I'm so thrilled to be with you, Senator Rounds, at the Washington AI Network. We've been watching the work you've done. Thank you for all the work on artificial intelligence. You just left the stage here at the Seed AI House at South by Southwest, and your message in health opportunities in AI was remarkable. Can we start there?
Sure.
And just, again, paint the vision of what you think is going to happen and is happening right now.
Artificial intelligence is a tool, and it's an accelerant. It means that you can do more research in a shorter period of time. We actually had testimony in D.C. last year in which one of the researchers said that they believed that we could do more research and get more results in a millisecond than a single lab could do in over 200 years of study. That type of acceleration means that you have an opportunity to do yes and no answers on different drugs and protocols that you could use in treatment of cancers, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, perhaps diabetes as well. And our goal would be, let's get as much research done using appropriate databases, good databases, so that in the end, in a shorter period of time, we can come up with answers to actually begin curing cancers, addressing the issues of diabetes, and delaying the onset of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's.
That's game-changing for health. How do you incorporate that into the existing systems?
We have a couple of different ways. First of all, in Washington, D.C., unless you work together across the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, it's really difficult to get things done. There's a group of us that came together to basically form a team to keep, on a bipartisan basis, the research into what makes AI work so that other Senate members could actually listen to it and learn from it and feel comfortable discussing it. Chuck Schumer, Todd Young, Martin Heinrich, and myself put together a series of nine separate, basically, gatherings last year for members of the Senate, in which we brought the brightest and sharpest AI developers and funders and so forth in, people from all walks of life, the labor unions, the healthcare organizations, the technologists, but people that were involved in AI, the large and the small. And they were giving us a sight of how we go to keep this all together in terms of the development of AI in the United States. It's not a matter of whether or not AI is going to be developed. The question is, where will it be developed, here or elsewhere? Whose standards will help to develop the protocols for AI in the future? And then also, how do you make sure that the benefits of it come back to the American people, which to me is the most important part of keeping confidence in the development of AI long term. We're going to use it. We already use it in the defense of our country. But for most people, I think they're going to see artificial intelligence actually benefiting them when it comes to health care. And that means you've got to have good databases that are shared. We have databases right now made up of people that benefit from Medicare and from Medicaid, veterans, and then your normal hospitals that receive payment, and your doctor's offices that actually treat other individuals with private insurance carriers. All of them, if we can put together anonymous databases, can be used to train AI models in the future. The more and the more accurate these databases are, the better chances we have of accelerating the types of protocols, the types of therapeutics, and perhaps the types of vaccines that would work in the future for going after just cancer as an example.
There's so many conversations about the big companies. And with open source, which is now pretty much accepted, there's more opportunities for smaller players. When you're talking about an issue that big as health and health AI, where do you think the answers will come? Is that at NIH? Is that private industry? And is there a way to collaborate on that? Because to your point, it's game changing for everyone. Every single person in the United States could have a better life with health AI.
That's right. And I think NIH is the National Institute of Health is where it should be coordinated from. But that doesn't mean that private organizations shouldn't play an active role in it. What I like about NIH is that they can anonymize the database to begin with so that we can get as much information as possible into the anonymous databases. But then once we start to find the cures and we find the items that could actually help individual Americans, I'd like to make sure that they can then go back in and identify people that have volunteered, that if we do find a way to perhaps help them, that we can send that information back to their doctor. So number one, all the data is anonymous to begin with, but then if we find something and somebody has said, yeah, let me know if there's something in my healthcare records that indicate that I'm prone to something and you can find a way to help me live a longer, healthier, higher quality of life, then let me know. I'd like to make sure that that's included in it as well. We've started a program, a bipartisan effort called Guide AI, in which we actually coordinate and add these different databases together so that they're actually readable in a systematic way. We've also got another one that's called MedShield, which would protect and look for the areas that could be used to create pandemic problems if they fall into the wrong hands. Those are two of the examples that we've used as things that we can do at the federal level that promote the use of AI, but also protect citizens from the dangers that AI could offer if they fell into the wrong hands. And we've got nation states out there right now that are studying ways to create these types of pandemics in the future. And we want to make sure that we stay ahead of them so that we can respond to them and stop them before they get out of hand.
So we have a new Trump administration, and we're a couple months in. Where do they stand on AI? Do they share some of the ideas that you have?
I think they do. And I've talked to the National Science Advisor already. They understand how critical AI is. I think it's fair to say that they understand it's not going away. And I think they're going to want to make sure that we utilize it. They really care about getting our budget under control. Using artificial intelligence and accelerating new discoveries with regard to some of the major illnesses means we can actually save money and promote a higher quality of life for those individuals. Nobody wants to be in a hospital over an extended period of time. If we can delay the onset of having to go to a hospital, and if we can get you out of a hospital more quickly, that saves taxpayer dollars, but it also means a higher quality of life for an individual. And like I was just sharing with the group a few minutes ago, Medicare is a really good example. That's what takes care of people that are over the age of 65. They've paid into the system for years, and now at the age of 65, this is the beginning of their health care protection. 2/3 of all the people that are on Medicare, these are folks over the 65, have two or more chronic illnesses. We spend over 93% of the money in Medicare on addressing those 2/3 of the people with chronic illnesses. So if we can reduce the onset of cancer, if we can eliminate diabetes, those are the types of things that we could really save dollars on and, once again, improve the quality of life.
You said today that with AI, cancer could be cured in 5 years.
Yeah. Over 2 years ago, in the discussions that we've had with individuals that made some presentations to us on national security, if we were to promote AI in terms of actually going in and coordinating the most advanced AI tools with the databases that we're combining right now, over the next 5 years, we can cure the vast majority of cancers that afflict mankind. To me, that's a real goal that we're now 2 years farther down the road than if we could have. And we've actually been trying to get the money, and it's billions of dollars, but in the big picture, it's like $3 to $4 billion the first year, $5 to $6 billion the second year, $7 to $8 billion the third year, to a total of about $40 billion over about a 6-year period of time. But the savings in terms of what it means for the taxpayer to be able to solve these issues in advance are huge and far outweigh the initial costs of the research involved. And one more thing, and this is the important part for me, think about the quality of life it provides for the families and for the individuals that are afflicted by these dread diseases. I think this is what's really going to drive the continued development of AI tools in the future, is when American families start to see that it's really impacting them and their families personally. Nobody wants to see a child with a cancer, and nobody wants to see a child having to go through years of treatment. If we can find those protocols, those treatments that can accelerate the curing of a cancer and the prevention of cancer, that's worth taking the risk of spending some money on research right now. And I just think every family out there that's got kids is going to feel that way. And anybody that's now in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, if there's a way to make sure that diabetes is eliminated, if there's a way to make sure that the onset of cancers can be delayed.
Well, it changes everything.
It changes everything.
It changes your family, everything around you.
You know, we talk about if you have your health, then everything else is kind of a small problem. And that's really the case here.
Now, I'm going to make a ridiculous turn to national security because that's your other area and actually how you got into artificial intelligence, right? And I wonder where you think we are now with DeepSeek and China and, again, the efforts of the new administration.
DeepSeek basically used American technologies, but they were very innovative in the way that they incorporated and the way they applied it. So it's a heads up to our developers here that there are other people also working really hard and we shouldn't let our guard down. It also means that as we move it forward, we can learn from other countries too as to how they've made strides forward. And I said this earlier today, artificial intelligence is here. It's been here for a long time. We just called it machine learning before, but it's not going to go away. And I know there's folks out there that say, you know, this is going to change mankind. They're going to run people out of jobs and everything. My message is it is here, it's not going away, so we have to deal with it. We do what we can to make sure that individuals are in control of it. But when it comes to our national defense, the same principles apply. Artificial intelligence is here, our adversaries are using it now, and they will use it in the future. We have to be faster, we have to be bigger, we have to be better. America has always said that we will protect our homeland by being in a position to where nobody wants to attack us. Artificial intelligence is the accelerator for the development of speed and capability in our offensive and in our defensive weapon systems. They're incorporated now, and our adversaries have incorporated them now. It's a matter of who will have the best systems, because it used to be that we talked about a kill chain. From the time in which you could spot an enemy and figure out which system you're going to use to go after them with it, and then to deliver a weapon to them to eliminate the threat, that was a kill chain. It's evolved from that. It's now a kill web, where it's multiple sensors looking, it's multiple ways of getting the information down to a decision maker, and it's multiple weapon systems that might be deployed in order to take out a threatening adversary. And China is doing the same thing today. With us, they're looking at the same types of things. So you have to be in a position to respond very quickly to hypersonic weapons, to non-kinetic weapons, cyber attacks in particular, which will always be the precursor to any attack on the United States, and literally to protecting your assets in space.
And let's talk about human in the loop,
yeah.
Which, as I understand it, is the guidance with our military and most of our allies. But there's automation bias. And the fact that the AI tells you this is the right target, if you're making a split-second decision, do you think twice about it? Can you talk about where the U.S. is on that and what you think is the right thing?
It used to be that any time you had a weapon system being activated, it was the human that actually made the decision to activate it. That's changing, because now with the speed of the delivery of weapons using ballistic missiles and using hypersonic weapon systems and so forth, the time from the chance in which you can identify the weapon until the time that you have to activate a defensive system is, in some cases, a few seconds in length. So what you have really today are more systems that are armed, where the human is not in the loop, but the human is on the loop, to where the human can stop it. It has it set up and ready to go, and it is armed. And if a weapon system does come in, it can be activated automatically. And that's because it's been armed and ready to go. But that human is still on the loop. Now, that's a defensive weapon system. There will come a time in which it will be a human over the loop, where everything will be automated and a human can turn it off, but it will be available. Now, those are for defensive weapon systems. There's a difference between your defensive weapon system and an offensive weapon system in which someone says, we found a target and we're prepared to take the target out. You have drones right now. They're called loitering drones. And loitering drones can go into a particular area that's been identified as a kill box. And in fact, the war between Azerbaijan and Armenia in 2020 was called the Nagorno-Karabakh War. They actually deployed these weapon systems where once these one-way drones were sent out, they had different types of weapon systems on them, but the drones communicated among themselves. The Azerbaijanians used them. These drones went into an area that were kill boxes, kilometers by kilometers in size. They would look in that area, and they would look for radar sites. They would look for artillery positions. They would look for command centers. They would look for formations of troops. And the drones, communicating only among themselves and not with any human, would identify which drone with which weapon system was best available to take out a particular target, whether it be an armored personnel carrier, an aircraft, a radar site. And then once all of the drones had identified their spots, they would then begin the attack without any human in the loop. Now, that's an offensive type of capability that is available and is in use today.
Wow. And what about space?
There are five domains: air, land and sea, space and cyberspace. Everybody uses space as the high ground. And this is where we have our systems that can look down on other countries. It's where we sense whether or not there's a rocket being launched, different types of sensors that can determine, you know, whether or not there's kinetic activity going on in areas. China has the same capabilities. Russia has the same capabilities or similar capabilities. And they're all in different parts of space. Some of them are in a low Earth orbit, some in a medium Earth orbit, some of them in a geostationary Earth orbit. But all of us use it. In space today, there are other countries that have already proven it. Well, the United States back 15 years ago proved that we could take out a satellite using a missile.
And China's always been really far ahead on space and AI.
China has tested theirs. Russia has tested theirs. They are advanced in both space and in AI. They are not quite up to where we are, but they are right on our heels. And they have developed a significant nuclear threat capability as well with both land-based missiles, and eventually they'll have the sea-based missiles as well. So we watch them and they watch us. What will happen in the future is that, and I think just as an example, and this is only my opinion, this isn't based on anybody telling me this is going to happen, but I think that China will notify us basically when they're ready to try to take on Taiwan. And I think most people realize that they have made it very clear that they want to get into Taiwan and that they will use military force if they have to. Some people think it's by the year 2027, some by 2028. It's whenever Xi Jinping decides that his military is capable, and they want to know what our response is. And the first thing that I believe they'll do is using the cyber domain, they will send a message to us that they have embedded things here within our systems. Telecommunication systems, power grids.
Well, we've read all about that recently.
And I don't know that we found them all. And I think the stock market will have some implications. When you go to get your airline ticket, you won't be able to get your airline ticket as easily. You may find that your power disruptions are occurring. This is the early warning that we'll see when it comes to China threatening us, saying, we know who you are, we know where you live, and we can do other things to you. So with that, I think that you'll find that China will, first of all, notify us by doing that. The second thing that we'll suddenly find is that some of our space-based assets will be limited in their capability. And that'll be China doing it to basically limit our ability to watch them in Taiwan. After that, I think they will try to take Taiwan, but probably not by force immediately, but probably try to subterfuge them. And if that does not work, then it would be a full-scale invasion. And their question is, will we be so preoccupied with the issues of not having social media available to us, not getting airline tickets, not having our cell phones work? Will we actually then want to take them on? I think that's their approach. And these are the types of things. When you talk about space, space is the key to it because this is the way we see everything else that's going on in that part of the world. And it's the way that they watch us.
One other area I have to ask you about, because there's no artificial intelligence without a tremendous amount of compute, and there's no compute without a tremendous amount of energy. So where do you think the biggest opportunity for expansion in the U.S. is?
Well, first of all, about 1,300 gigawatts of power is what we use in the United States today. We're going to need about 130 gigawatts more by the year 2030 in the world. We can produce about 30 gigawatts more by 2030 using nuclear capabilities and so forth. we need an all of the above energy plan. The supply chain is what's going to hold up the production of natural gas plants, because we got to have turbines, and there's a limited number of turbines that we can build between now and the year 2030. One data center will use up to about a half a gigawatt of power. So when you start talking about a half gigawatt of power, and we can maybe do 30 total in the United States, that is not a lot of new data centers. And that's going to be shared with a lot of people using a lot more energy. So I think, number one, you've got to have power coming in from every source available. You may very well have to restart some of the power plants that have been shut down. You have to push nuclear. Space-based solar power, I believe long-term, is probably an alternative.
How does that work?
Right now, we know that China actually 2 years ago started talking about it. And if you think about it, you have a satellite in orbit around the Earth that is capturing direct sunlight. You don't have an atmosphere to go through. It is extremely efficient. With large satellites, you can catch a significant amount of solar radiation. You can convert that. We know that right now because we do that on Earth. But in that particular case, if you're talking databases, why not actually have your compute centers in space? Why not take them there where you have perhaps a little bit less of a cooling issue and you don't have to transport it? But we also know, because we have cell phones today, that you don't have to touch something in order to transmit power to it. That technology exists as well. So there will be times in the future where we will transmit power from satellites that orbit the Earth back down to the Earth using technologies that are available today.
That's pretty exciting news.
It is.
I like that.
But there's something else we should say. I think in the next 5 years, we're not going to have enough power to keep up with the demand for databases. And they're either going to move outside the United States, or we're going to have innovation here in the United States that is going to make the systems that we've got right now that use huge amounts of power, they're going to become more efficient. And I think the people that actually develop the more efficient systems will be billionaires, not millionaires. And I think that's one of the next key parts in this, is how do we make the data systems that use huge amounts of power today actually more efficient, and the compute power needed such that it can live within the power constraints we've got today.
That's pretty exciting. Thank you, Senator Rounds. It's so great to have you here. We're at the Seed AI House. It's an honor to interview you. Thank you for all your bipartisan work on AI. We've learned a lot tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. And let me just say again, we need this on a bipartisan basis. We've got great bipartisan friends. Martin Heinrich is my co-chair with me on the AI caucus. He's a great guy to work with. And we fully intend to do this on a bipartisan basis in the Senate.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, let's turn to Congressman Zach Nunn for his take on the future of AI in defense, agriculture, and beyond. This is the Washington AI Network. We're at the Seed AI House. And my new, can I call you my bestie?
Absolutely,
my
Tammy. We're tight.
My new favorite congressman. Don't tell all the rest.
I'll keep it quiet from 134 other guys.
It'll okay, great. Thank you very much, Congressman Zach Nunn. It's so great to have you here. And I'm so glad you're here talking about defense, because there's no bigger opportunity in artificial intelligence than on the defense side. Now, we have a new administration in the White House. New priorities. What do you think the top priorities should be in defense?
Well, I mean, Tammy, I think not just defense. We should be looking at artificial intelligence across the board for what it does for the entire globe. But in the United States alone, we're talking about a $15 trillion over the course of the next 10 year build out of the economy. We're talking about 100 million jobs created because of AI. This isn't going to be a job killer. It's a job grower. In my home state of Iowa, it means a 70% increase in agricultural output because of what AI brings to precision farming, execution, supply chain. There are so many sectors that are going to be impacted in a really good way. I think it's important to talk about defense, though, because this is an area where we need to be at the leading edge of not only the innovation, but the application. And that comes with not just AI, but the individuals who are tasked with doing it. That means a Marine infantryman has to be familiar with AI, just like a four-star general or a member of Congress has to know how we're going to deploy AI. It becomes an exciting space, but it also means we've got a lot of work to do, both on the workforce side, everything that is the infrastructure behind AI, and then deploying AI in a, what I will call a federated way, so the best innovations aren't locked up in top companies in Silicon Valley or top policymakers in DC, but can reach every Main Street mom and pop kid in the garage to really use AI in pretty exciting new ways.
Well, you were in the Air Force. You were in intelligence. We'll leave it there.
Yeah.
But everything's changed so quickly since you left. And now you're in Congress, and you also served in the state of Iowa. And all of this is in your hands.
Yeah.
Right? You have so much say in how it's going to be deployed and how to communicate it to people. How do you communicate it to people that they don't feel like it's for everyone else and maybe not for us?
Right. So I think there's two things. One, we got to make this tangible. Talking about AI in the ethereal, it sounds like sci-fi. When I'm here at Seed AI, one of the things we've showcased is how this helps a local entrepreneur really identify and recruit candidates for a very bespoke business. Or a radiologist do a second scan look at somebody's x-ray so they can find where a fine fracture is. At the same time, I think we in the defense sector have seen, I worked prototypes for the chief of staff of the Air Force, and one of the things we did is we looked at how mainland China, also using artificial intelligence, was hyper-targeting voters in Taiwan and leveraging economic sanctions against rural farmers in Taiwan at the local level elections to try and turn regional governments in favor of Beijing and against Taipei. And they did it so highly effectively that large swaths of rural Taiwan were all voting for the communist Chinese candidate over their own best interests because of the threat of what the Chinese were offering and sanctions on things like pineapples, where 80% go to mainland China. So it's being weaponized in a way that we've got to find not only a counter to it, we've got to be able to outpace them. And some of the things I'm leading in Congress as well. We have an AI Plan Act, which we're running through Committee on Jurisdiction, House Financial Services, to make sure that the federal government knows all the regulations that are already out there, and we don't create new burdensome regulations when these innovators are really leading it. The second one we're leading is called the Clarity Act, and this is so that we can build the infrastructure behind the future of AI, something called blockchain, which is really how data is going to be managed in the future, that it's a made in America infrastructure, not from a near competitor. And right now, the Chinese are very aggressively building their own blockchain models that could not only compete with the U.S., but could derail the rest of the world from operating the way the United States can have information advantage.
Okay, you're taking my breath away. There's so much going on with China.
Yeah.
How does the U.S. decide what's the most important way to fight back?
Yeah, no.
I mean, because look what happened with DeepSeek, right? And maybe we should thank DeepSeek because it got the entire country's attention. Hey, wait, they're doing something we're doing. They're doing it better, faster, less power. First of all, do you believe all the things they've said?
You know, here's the thing. Whether the hype is real or not, I think the reality is China wants to compete in this space. They are a centralized command, centralized execution government, and they have the resources to be a real competitor in this space. Now, the United States, we're kind of the opposite. We're centralized idea, decentralized execution, which makes our innovation fantastic. But I know this much. The United States taxpayer is not going to be able to pay for this investment alone. We've got to have real partnership. That means partnerships with VCs, but it also means partnerships with Main Street guys, hometown farmers who also want to be part of the solution here. It gives us some really exciting opportunities to invest. You know, Stargate's going in with $500 billion, half a trillion dollars from a conglomerate of OpenAI research methodologies that we can be competitively advantaged over China. Here's what I will say. DeepSeek, and again, 20 years as a counterintelligence officer, provides China with some economic opportunities. It also provides them a great window to steal from other countries. Target number one is going to be the United States. And we know this is true because in the last year alone, you know, the Typhoon series, Volt Typhoon, Silk Typhoon, these have all targeted everyone from President Trump and candidate Kamala Harris down to you and me based on our telcos. Just this year, they went after the Department of Treasury with no real pushback. And this is the area where I think both in AI, certainly we've learned from cybersecurity, we can't just be defensive and try and build a fortress America. We have got to be able to be more innovative. We've got to outpace our adversary, and we've got to go into a real offensive-defensive mode, meaning that we are proactive in our defense, but also in leveraging these technologies to hold not only China at bay, but to do it faster than they can do it to us.
Well, if you look at ships,
yeah,
at commerce, and all the various cuts, dare I mention DOGE,
right?
It sounds like this is all a little bit of a distraction, separate from actually cutting government, a distraction from what you're making it sound like is a very immediate need to address.
Yeah, and here's where I will say it's a well-used term for a reason, public-private partnerships. When I served on the National Security Council, we realized that we weren't going to be able to fight cybersecurity single-handed out of the White House. We had to have our banking partners, our energy partners, all on board. It's one of the reasons that we created these ISACs to really go after sector-specific
defense. What's an ISAC?
Yeah, an ISAC is a sector-specific lead for things like cybersecurity, information sharing between the private sector, between the government, so that we can best defend. It worked very well for our banks in the financial sector. We did it for energy. Now we do it for everything from transportation all the way down. The same can be true here for AI. It is going to touch every aspect of our life. The food that you eat, the car that you drive, whatever you're scrolling on your phone tomorrow or on your HoloLens in the future, this is all going to have sector-specific needs. And I want to make sure that the government is there to provide the safety rails, but I want the innovation to be successful. And with that innovation comes the opportunity to make a lot of money for folks who want to get into this. And that's candidly how we pay for it going forward. That's where I see the current Trump administration, whether it's digital assets or artificial intelligence, saying, we've got really smart folks in America. Let's give them the opportunity and the investment tools to take this out of the gate. That's how we'll outpace our rivals. But it's also one of the areas where we're not asking the taxpayer to be on the hook for every research grant, to create every potential platform to do this. And a lot of these are going to fail, and that's okay. But we don't want them failing on top of $36 trillion in deficit spending the U.S. government's doing. Let's let them fail in the open market, because other people will learn from that and it'll make it better the next time.
All right, let's go to farmers.
Yeah.
How is AI helping farmers in your district today?
Well, you know, I'm a sixth generation farm kid. I grew up with row crop and we were the foolish ones that put sheep in our livestock.
Oh, why is that foolish?
Well, because sheep are just dumb animals. That's the first and foremost part. Fun to show at the state fair. Come to Iowa and check it out.
I was going to say, I've been to the Iowa State Fair.
Yeah.
Did you? Multiple times. I absolutely love it. I want to get one of a minivan or an RV. Have you ever done that and just hung out there? I have friends that just go there and live there for 2 weeks.
This is the crazy part to segue into this. You know what? If you want to have your camper or your RV at the state fair, it is one of the only things you can deed to the next generation. Because your guy has been camping the fair for four generations on, they do not give up those spots. So AI in ag, I think, is one of the most exciting things. We are going to see AI help Iowa farmers and ag across America grow 70% in the next 5 years. Think about this. Precision ag means a drone having the ability to kill a single weed, the minimal amount of input cost, but the maximum effect of being able to kill an invasive species without destroying the soil or getting it in the waterway. Drones, technology that will be on the side of a planter, on the side of a harvester, things that can execute very quickly. Equally important, we're helping farmers become that next generation of real bioscientists on planting a seed when the soil temperature is perfect, making sure that a herd full of cattle, we know which heifer is getting sick earlier on so we can help her and also quarantine her from the herd. And certainly what we saw just in Iowa this year, the culling of 500,000 turkeys because of an avian flu outbreak, we can get ahead of this much earlier to not only help keep that flock there, not have an insurance draw on that farmer, but make sure that all of us have a more affordable Thanksgiving because we've been able to keep more birds alive. And that goes from everything from eggs to livestock across the board. The exciting part here is the U.S. now has an opportunity not only to grow ag, but help feed and fuel the future of this country and the world.
So is that the Agriculture Department inspecting and alerting, or is that private industry?
This is almost exclusively private industry. The USDA has been a partner on the grant side, but I'd say even the USDA has been, like a lot of government, slow to catch up. It's one of the reasons we've talked to David Sacks, the new guy for crypto and AI at the White House, to really highlight how important AI in every faucet is going to be important. But for our main sector industries, and I would put ag at one of the top of these, we really have the opportunity to revolutionize this. This is bigger than the horse and the plow. This is going on to a very new way of how we're going to have everything from an autonomous tractor covering 80,000 acres to empowering more farmers to be able to have much better conservation practices while still being able to feed a much larger population.
What did you think about the crypto summit on Friday?
This is one area that we know is going to march out. The other committee I serve on is House Financial Services. We serve on the digital assets piece. I think we're going to start with something called stablecoin, American dollar backed stablecoin. I think it's important that we have digital assets that have confidence, that are based in the United States. And some of that means we need to onshore it back to the U.S. Candidly, in the last 4 years, we had an administration very focused on regulation. Everybody knows the SEC was crushing innovators in the digital asset space. It sent guys to the Bahamas, and that's where we got FTX that collapsed because they were operating outside the norms. And then sent some of our best allies to places like London and Singapore. Let's onshore those. At the same time, I would say there are competitors in this space, non-US backed stablecoins, digital assets, and ultimately cryptocurrencies. These guys, whether they're in Moscow, Tehran, Beijing, have the ability to bleed out wealth. And candidly, investors are going to go wherever they get a good return on investment. Let's make sure this is US based. I'm very excited that House Financial Services has put together a package that allows digital assets to grow up in the commodities market where innovation can be rich and regulation more restricted, and then matriculate or graduate to the SEC where we can have everything from Bitcoin and beyond that is a trusted source for Americans that we know is US backed and that cuts down on illicit financing. And those are the two areas I'm looking at, the graduation model and combating illicit digital asset.
Well, you've got Meta, Amazon. They're also in the digital payment space too, and only more, right?
That's right.
So if you're a consumer, how will you know what to do?
Well, and this is where there is a role for government, right? I mean, this is where the partnership comes in. The innovation should absolutely be done on the private sector side. The confidence verification, combating illicit financing, that's the responsibility of government. And that's what our Treasury Department, our Department of Justice should be doing and does do very well. We don't want to regulate it out of existence, but once we say, hey, this has met the threshold, we want to make sure other people aren't poaching from it, aren't destabilizing it in the same way we would the U.S. dollar. So we've got a good, you know, model here with 200 years of banking history in the United States. Let's leverage that into a new way that people are going to accept payments and ultimately save consumers, save small businesses a lot of money from everything from the exchange fee to the credit card fees. Now we can do this pretty seamlessly. People are going to have a lot more control over their own dollar, how they want to spend it, and what they can buy with it.
And that's what they want.
That's exactly right.
Okay, what about TikTok?
You know, TikTok to me is a clear example of where Congress, the courts, the intelligence community, and the American people all came together and said, we do not want our information going to China. TikTok as an entity, as a platform, pretty exciting. The very fact that it's owned by a wholly owned subsidiary of the Chinese Communist Party, even more concerning though.
Why do you think that's still a conversation?
I think this was the first big thing that touched every American in some capacity. I also think that the ability of the Chinese to leverage TikTok when there was fear of it shutting down should send a cold shiver down every American spine. Mobilizing the U.S. populace to take a political action that was in favor of a Chinese outcome is very concerning.
It's like a Veep episode, right?
Yes, absolutely right.
But it's a real one.
I want to give Tammy a shout out here. It's one of the leads in helping create and authenticate Veep. This is a real world scenario that is going to be popping up again and again. I mean, there's a telling reason here, completely a Veep episode. The Chinese don't even allow this in their own country, but are happy to export it to the United States. And they're effectively using our own kids against their government right now. So there's an opportunity to keep the platform, certainly, but we do not want to have it tethered to a Chinese state interest capability to influence ops us right here at home.
Let's go back to the military.
Yeah.
How is the U.S., how's the government now teaching military AI? All the things that you know with all your experience, there has to be an integration of AI. I don't mean in the people that are deploying weapons. First of all, is there an ongoing effort now, or what would you recommend?
Well, first and foremost, I think the bulk of the U.S. military is made up by folks under the age of 35. And that's a really good thing, because a lot of these folks are going to walk in the door with inherent knowledge of how they use AI, even if they don't call it AI to its face. The older guys used AOL dial-up back in the day. I'm still having to learn this stuff, and I'm still in the reserve serving as a colonel. I teach now, but I still get the opportunity to fly and do operations, which is great.
What do you fly?
We're on the RC-135. It's a reconnaissance aircraft. I'm the airborne intelligence officer. So we flew operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. Most recently, I commanded a unit off the coast of Russia.
Well, you just buried the lead there. What was that like? You can't go on. You have to explain that.
So we flew operations, one, monitoring what the Russians were doing, both in the Syrian and Crimea area. We were also looking at the Baltics and Barents Straits area. This is really important because how Russia operates isn't confined to just what it's doing in places like Ukraine. They're operating all over the world still. And so, yeah, we would fly and watch their missile launches, watch their Air Force reactions. We had multiple interactions with Russian fighters who would come and try and force us off. And we're an unmanned reconnaissance platform, but we're in international waters. This is what sovereign nations do. So it's an opportunity for us. Where I will highlight this is the amount of technology that I was using, even, you know, a few years ago, has been revolutionized in what we can do for all this collection. I can take so much information that would take decades of an intel analyst combing through all this information that we've got. Radar signatures, response times, coordination, command and control nodes. With AI, we've now had the opportunity to refine this that as soon as I'm off the plane, I can get an entire synthetic capture of what's happening in Russian aerospace, even down to the fact of like which pilots are going to fly which type of profiles,
Wow. Which
ones we know are going to be more aggressive before they even take off, and how effectively the Russians are going to deploy certain airframes as a deterrent. So much of this can be put into a larger battle map. I was just out in Indo-PACOM. We have seen the four-star commander out there do fantastic things with Project Maven, which is an artificial intelligence tool used by the Department of Defense to really look at saying, we've got 30 years of training to repel maybe, let's say, a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. Who's gone back to look at how much has changed and put all of these into one database that we can all pull on? And this is going to become only more important when we put a 27-year-old lieutenant in the front seat of an F-22, the only seat, and ask it to drive, you know, a squadron of autonomous vehicles ahead of it, the Loyal Wingman program, because every decision he or she makes is now going to be compounded by the fact that they're driving an entire air element into a contested airspace. AI has got to be able to do so much of the thinking for that pilot so that they can be most effective, not only to have survivability of the pilot, but to ensure that we have the ability to execute in a potential conflict where our adversary is going to be much closer to their home shore and we're going to be the ones playing the away game. So we better be able to bring it to fight and steamroll them in the first battle. Otherwise, our supply chains alone are going to cost us.
Sounds like you're saying that the U.S. is still ahead of China.
In many areas, yes. China's going to have some tactical advantages. One, we have to go to them to have a deterrent strategy. They have far more attributable assets that they can just throw at it. I mean, this is the World War II model of just throw pilots in the sky, throw boats in the water, have a low-cost trawler or UAV that strikes out at a U.S. capital ship. We've seen it in Ukraine already. I've told everyone I think Ukraine is Spain 1936. We should be learning from the innovation that's going on there, how they use drones, how they use jammers, how they use low-cost technology to put a traditional military on its heels. But I also think we need to not overestimate China and think that they have the capability to do everything all the time. China has a very heavy command and control structure. And what we know is that if the guys at the MSS or the PLA in Beijing don't give that order, the Chinese military will not operate autonomously, which is the opposite of the U.S. The danger is, if we inadvertently isolate Beijing and they're executing on the last order they received, we can see a Chinese military and a Chinese state that continue to function long after we've decapitated their leadership team. So, and I don't mean actually kill, although that may be the case, but isolate them to the point where they can't update their last remaining order.
Wow. Elon Musk. So here he is, has all of this great success, Starlink, Tesla, other companies, and now he's in government. And so if you pulled him aside and say, hey, buddy, let me help you out and tell you what's really going on here.
Yeah. So he came and spoke to us recently, and I will give mad credit to anybody who can launch a rocket into space and land the fuel jet on a card table the size of the one in front of us. Some things translate over really well. And I think that he has been clear. A bureaucracy as big as the U.S. government, we need to be able to say, let's move fast, let's move aggressively. If there are things that we inadvertently break, let's come back and reattack those. And I've seen both sides of it. I know that we've got a Department of Ag, for example, that has only a very low amount of its workforce returning to the workspace. And a lot of the things they're doing, whether it's paper copies or moving things physically, could be automated, could be made far more efficient. But I've also seen the other side where in my home state of Iowa, they said, don't cut these guys. They're frontline warriors for us at USDA. My farmers need them. Let's either reinstate them if they were cut or on the chopping block, or let's keep them because here's what they're doing. And candidly, he's been very responsive to that. You've already seen the president say department agency heads are now responsible for taking ownership of their workforce. But I know this much should be true. There are tens of billions of dollars in fraud, waste, and abuse out there that we have asked for as Congress for oversight for years and have never gotten the answers that we deserve, and more importantly, the American taxpayer deserves. In the first 45 days, the amount that this team has been able to uncover as just blatant waste and abuse is frightening. And I think that this is an area that the American taxpayer has been asking for. And this cuts across all political stripes, Republican, Democrat, or independent. People want to know that their government is protecting them. And most importantly, if we're going to take money out of your pocket, you better be using it in the best way possible.
And you don't feel like he's overstepping Congress's role?
You know, I think this is a compliment, candidly. Congress has a very important role in the oversight piece, but Congress is not an action officer. Elon has become the president's action officer for saying, we're going to go out there, we're going to find all these things. Congress, you got to codify it, you're going to correct this. I'll give you a perfect example. He came in and said, I'm just going to audit everybody from the Small Business Administration who's 114 years and over that's received a loan. 3,000 loans go out, hundreds of millions of dollars to those 3,000 recipients. And then he said, the oldest living American's 114, so a year younger. So we've got massive fraud, and that's just in Small Business Administration. These are things that should naturally be caught, and we haven't always empowered our agencies to really go after that.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Someone has lived in D.C. forever. He's been given the go-ahead to do it.
Yeah.
Because these policies don't just happen. There's a process, and they're there because there was a plan behind them.
Right, right. And this is where I want, you know, our good civil servants to feel empowered to also stand up on this. A lot of this, as Elon has told us, it's not intentional fraud. It's negligence and in some cases, blatant incompetence. Perfect example, military contractor gets a pristine or exquisite system, pays it out, the system's canceled, the military contractor moves on, and the money is still going out the door. Nobody ever hit the stop button on this. These things are frightening, but we haven't had the ability to just do basic level auditing because nobody wanted to take the risk of saying, this could be much worse than I want. If anything, Elon's become a lightning rod, but he's also absorbing a lot of the risk that some of these good civil servants just haven't been empowered to do.
And he's a lightning rod in another sense, too. I'm talking about AI because he's a doom scroller person. It's the end of the world and all that. Yet he has his own company in it. And in a way, he represents what some people think that this is going to destroy the world. So if you were standing next to him now, how would you convince them that they've got it all wrong?
Well, here's the thing. We know this much is true. AI is bigger than any one individual. AI is going to be bigger than any one company. And AI is going to touch so many facets, even some master plan by one individual is going to be quickly undone when it is democratized, small d, federated out to the people who are going to be using it. And I think we're going to see the real innovation is coming from our kids doing it on their phone or a small farmer in Iowa who said, I just revolutionized the space. The next trillionaire is in our lifetime, and it's going to come from somebody we haven't even heard from yet. We'll think of them as like the Ma Bell world 10 years from now.
Well, it's so great to talk to you, Congressman.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your service, and thank you for still working with the Air Force.
Always a privilege. Thanks, Tammy.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this South by Southwest edition of the Washington AI Network podcast. Special thanks to Austin Carson and the entire gang at Seed AI for having us with them. See you soon. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.